accession number 10421, reel 20.
Mr. Leslie Thornton, reel 20. You were at Arama, Mr. Thornton. Can you go on from your last discussion, which was really about the leaves you were having?
Yes. Well, from Arama, we went on a sort of an exercise, really, to Syria. And we were in tents. The Arama was still a sort of base, but we were in tents in a place near Beirut. Now, it was a good place for the training of the mortar platoon and the carriers, because it was where the other place is all flat. This was in Syria, it was rather hilly, and so they could get an experience of the carriers and the mortars taking cover. As you know, mortars can always take cover because they have a high trajectory and go straight over the hills, so they don't have to be in the open. So that was a good thing there. We weren't there very long. But while we were there, I'll tell you about this chap. I had an anti-tank. The anti-tank were there, of course, and they could manoeuvre their guns in this type of country. And the sergeant, the senior sergeant, was a sergeant called Charlie Hallett, Sergeant Hallett. Now, he's a good chap, and he was a first-class referee before he was called up, football referee. And he came to me one day, and he said that he felt a bit sick, and could I put him on a sick report? So I said, righto. I said to him, how old are you, Sean Hallett? He said, 41. So I said, well, you go sick and tell the MO that you're 41. I said, you're not supposed to be in action at over 41. So he went there and he came back, and the categories in the army went like A1, A2, A3, which was reasonable. Then they went a B, B1, B2, and so on, and then C. Now, the overage one, he was A1, but they put an X in between the A and the 1 to make AX1, which meant he was fit, but he was overage for action in war. So he was posted to a safe job and never went with us anymore. Now, everybody, of course, in action is not under 41. You see, you get the colonel, the brigadiers, the generals, naturally going to be older, but they haven't got to stand the rigours like a private soldier and a sergeant and the young officers up to the major, because when they've completed their give their orders out, and they've got a caravan to go to, and so they're quite happy, and that's why a general is able to do his job at 60. So we never saw Sean Hallett anymore. Now, while we were there, we were camped next to a Gurkha battalion. Now, this was a very young Gurkha battalion who were itching to get into war, but they were young and not fully trained. So they were doing the training in Syria. Well, they were you daren't compete against them in smartness, because we came from Italy, our clothes. They were in a tented camp. It was a permanent camp, and they used to do guards, a quarter guard, which is means a headquarter guard, and their creases in their KD and all that, and absolutely spick and span. And we, of course, were a bit scruffy, but that didn't matter. The Gurkhas thought the world of a British soldier. So this particular time, the two officers got together, my company commander and one of the Gurkha company commanders, and said, will you play us football? So they said they arranged the football match with the Gurkhas. The Gurkhas played in the bare feet, and we had our not football boots, but slippers on, you know, canvas shoes. And had a damn good game with the young Gurkhas. And it all finished up nice and square, 2 goals each. I was playing football at the time. And after that, we were invited to the Havildar's mess, the Havildar being the sergeant's mess. And although a lot of my team were privates, they were invited in the sergeant's mess, which is very unusual. In the British Army, sometimes it happened, but very unusual. I think at one time when the DLI won the Army Cup, the RSM had the team for a drink all in the sergeant's mess. But I'd say that was a one-off. So we all trooped into the sergeant's mess, and they brought the beer out, not much, that much beer. So it was a bottle of beer or something like that, and something to eat. But not only that, they came in with the other drink, which were buckets of rum. Now, how the Gurkhas got as much rum, I don't know, because we very seldom got an issue of rum. It had to be really, really, really bad, because our divisional commander, General Hawkshead, didn't believe in it. So it had to be bad before we got one, but they brought in these buckets of rum. Now, you could see the discipline in these young lads. Every time the company commander left the room, probably go to the toilet, the sergeants all stood up. Every time he came back, they all stood up. Now, that would never happen in the British Army. It wasn't expected. When they were in the sergeant's mess, they were guests. But this happened at the Gurkhas. And so we had a good night with them. And I'm afraid that our lads got a bit round the bend. No fighting or anything like that, but they got a bit drunk. And one of the Havildars said, I take you, Sergeant Major, to your tent. So there was a wadi in between us, and they made sure that I got there all right, and made sure that I got into my tent and into bed. That is how much these Gurkhas thought of the British soldier. But I must mention this. My company commander said, when he saw them on parade doing a quarter guard, he said, I think we'll have a quarter guard on, Sergeant Major. I said, you won't, sir. I said, not in your life. He says, do you want to be showed up with the Gurkhas, doing a quarter guard in the kit we've got, not ironed or anything like that? So there was no quarter guard. He saw the logic of it, not to do a quarter. All we did, you see, all we were doing at the time was pickets. Six men on a picket, just patrolling around the camp with a rifle slung over the shoulder, and doing their ordinary patrols. So that was that.
Can you recall the name of the place that?
Well, not only near Beirut. It wasn't a particularly. I don't think it had a name. It was in the hills, just a camp, but it was near Beirut. I think I did mention that we did go to Mena Camp. I don't know whether I did, but anyhow, we went to Mena Camp because the 1st Battalion were there. A few of the sergeant's mess went in a truck, and we had our celebrations there, meeting all our old sergeants out of the 1st Battalion, and then we drove back to Arama this time. We'd moved back to Arama. And, of course, we were going along the road, and the driver was trundling along, and the RSM was in the front, and suddenly the driver was off the road. So it was dark, of course, pitch dark. The RSM told him to stop. Fortunately, for us, when the RSM got out of the truck to have a look round, we were on the edge of a wadi. And another few feet and we'd been down it. So the RSM said, move over. He'd had a couple of drinks, this lad, in the camp at the 1st Battalion. And he drove the truck back to camp and got us back all right. But that's what can happen in a desert, going off the road. So then we'd finished... at this place, we went back to Kiffar Yonah. And from there, on the that was on the 4th of June. But on the 18th of June, we went back to Kusatin, which was the first camp we went to when we left Forside. And we were told then that we would soon be back in Italy. You see, all this that I'm telling you now is out of my head, because it's not in any books, any of this stuff that I'm mentioning now. It was just a half a page of the Middle East, and then it's back to Italy. So these are the things I can remember what happened in the Middle East. So off we went, and on the 28th of June, we went to Portside, and lo and behold, there was the Sobieski lying there, the ship that we came on.
What was the feeling in the battalion about going back to Italy?
Well, they'd had a good rest. The spirits were a lot higher than when they left Italy to go to the Middle East. So it really wasn't too bad. I think they had an idea when we got to them, weren't going home or anything like that, that when they started training, obviously everybody knew that at one stage we would be going back to Italy to have another go at the Germans. Well, that's of course, came to be true.
And you had no problems with anyone who didn't want to go back?
No. Well, we had we met the Soviets again, and we met the petty officers that were on the ship that brought us over. And fortunately, we'd had a whiskey ration. And we said to the petty officers when we left, well, if we see you again, we'll treat you after you give us a couple of glasses of rum when we come back. So we had a bottle of whiskey, and we met the same chaps, and for a couple of nights they brought their rum out, we brought our whiskey out, so we had a little celebration in the petty officers' cabins. Now on we went for another 6 days' journey over the sea to Italy again. Just before we left Middle East, we were told that the colonel was leaving. That was Colonel Preston. Everybody called him Johnny. Not to his face, of course, but he was Johnny Preston. And he was absolutely loved by the men, because he thought the devil had left them and made sure that they were looked after. And he was going as a staff officer to the 78th Armoured Division. And everybody was pretty sad about that, because they knew that they would never get another colonel like him to command them when they got back into action again. Anyway, he did come and see us again on a visit, on a flying visit, when we got back to Italy. But it was a really sad thing.
He left you before you got on board the ship, did he?
He left us in, yes.
And when did his successor turn up?
He was already there. He was the second in command. Major Worrell. Now, Major Worrell was a Dorset man. He was out of the Dorset Regiment. So you get a lot of seconded people, you get a lot of change of regiments with officers during the war. And he belongs to the Dorsets. Now, he was second in command, and he took over as colonel when we got back.
Was he highly thought of?
Not as well as Colonel Preston, I'm afraid. Not as well at all.
But, what way did he differ from?
Well, they didn't think he was as efficient. In this is going later on, of course, as efficient as the colonel. And well, I can't explain really, exactly their feelings. But I didn't think he was as efficient. I shouldn't. This, of course, won't get out, because it'll be a long time before anybody like that listens to it, I suppose. Now, the journey back, well, there was nothing to do except rest. But one night, one of the stewards came into the sergeant's lounge where we were drinking our orangeade. Now, we got back onto the soft drinks, you see, in the lounge, no beer or anything, and said, would you like to come out and see a sight? Apparently the ship was naturally all blacked out, and you had to go through one door, close it, to get onto the side of the ship. Close that and then go on to the side of the ship. So we all trooped out, and he said, "There you are." And we looked out to sea. And there, in eruption, was Stromboli, the volcano in the middle of the sea. Well, you know, it's anything like it. It's absolutely marvellous. A great orange ball in the middle of the sea, where it was belching forth. It's one of the greatest sights I've seen, really, I think, to see a thing like that in the middle of an ocean. Well, that was that. And then we got again to Naples. And disembarked. And went to a place near Capua in southern Italy, or Capua, whatever. The little place was called San Secondina. And there they started to do a little bit of platoon training and cleaning of weapons and little things like that. Only there for a few days, and then off we went to our assembly point, which is a place called Bastardo, a little village, near Assisi, the famous pilgrims' visiting place. It's not very far away. The battalion was spread about in the area of Bastardo, all in tents, but undercover, more cover for protection against air. Not that we'd seen much of the German Air Force in Italy, I'm afraid. Very little indeed. I think they'd been more or less grounded with the Air Force, the Americans and ours. I think most of the Americans. So we didn't see much of them, and I don't think there was any instance where I can say we were bombed by aircraft.
About what date is this, Mr.
This Lee? Was the 12th of July when we got to Bastardo.
Are you far from the front at this?
Quite a while yet, yes. Well, while at Bastardo, we started and we played football every day. Doing the maintenance of the weapons and vehicles, of course. Don't forget, we had no vehicles to come over with. All our vehicles had to go for them, collect them, and have them prepared, ready to go into action. A few route marches were done. Football every day, company competitions at football, and the battalion was at the peak of fitness at that time. So you can imagine the morale was very high. We had a, what they call it again, we had a fete, a garden fete while we were there. All sorts of things, coconut shies made of some kind of thing. Run by one of the officers, he's dead now, is Tom Reynolds. He was a captain. And it was a marvellous day. There was nothing much else done. Some officers went away to the front and were seconded to the 51st Tank Regiment. Now, that was to get experience of tank warfare, because the 51st Tank Regiment were going to be our supporting tanks. I don't think I mentioned, but when I talked about the Middle East, the whole division were in the Middle East, not just the DLI. The whole division had gone over, and by this time now in July, all the division were back in Italy, waiting at these various assembly points to go up the front line. We had a picture show while we were there, you know, a mobile cinema. I can't remember what the film was, but and we also had the divisional dance band, which, of course, just played music. I don't think you can imagine the soldiers dancing with each other, but it was nice to hear a band.
Did you get any lectures or talks about the impending action as you were going to?
Yes, we couldn't tell as much But the thing that we were told that this was going to be the final battle for Italy. The general of the army was General Sir Oliver Lees, and now we were changing over. We were not any longer in the Fifth Army, by controlled by the American Army, but we were back in the Eighth Army. Of course, General Montgomery had gone home, and Sir Oliver Lees had taken over the Eighth Army, and that's the army we were going to be commanded by. The line that the Germans were holding on to was called the Gothic Line, and that was the last bastion of the Italian campaign, or it was going to be, as I say. So we finished our washing there. A funny thing about it, this nobody knew. Well, I suppose they did, but didn't say anything. We did our washing in petrol. It was very hot by then, southern Italy, and we had our KD on, and we used to dump it in a tin of petrol, toss it up and down a couple of times, hang it on the tent guy ropes, and the sun used to dry it out. It was clean as whistle. And that's how we did our washing, especially when there was no water hanging about. But that is something that. Nobody should have known about it. It would make it seem there was more petrol hanging about than there was water. Well, the time came then. You see, this is going to be a bit disjointed now. I mean, my memory is now, I'll have to think a lot about the little places. I don't know the places, but the action that we took part in, and more what happened in the place. We went to a place called Isola del Piano. Now this was getting near the front line.
Have any idea again of dates?
It would be, I think, the middle of July, roughly. Maybe the end of July. And we went to this place called Isola del Piano, and this was an assembly place ready for front line. There was going to be an attack on a place called Petriano. Now this is the place where I picked up the phone one day, and it said, "Sergeant Major Thornton," I said, "Aye." The phone, I think it would be field telephone at the time. "I'm afraid we've got news for you. Sergeant Major Matton has been killed. You've got to go immediately to take over C Company, Sergeant Major, urgently." I said, "What about the company here?" "Forget about that. We'll sort that out. Off you go." So, of course, a jeep was sent, and I got my kit together, and off I went to report to C Company.
What was your thoughts? Or can you recall your thoughts at this time, moving from support to a front, a rifle company?
Well, not very pleased, actually. I knew that I was going to be more liable to be killed now than I was before. I mean, I was more liable to be killed by small arms fire or mortar fire than shell fire. So I wasn't very pleased, but of course it was a job to do, and had to be done. So I reported, and now the company commander was a wartime soldier, Pat Casey from Jarrow. He was a school teacher, grand chap, down to earth. Said, "Right, I've arrived." So I got cracking with the company clerks, checking up the platoon sergeant, the state of the ammunition, etc. I dumped a lot of ammunition, old stuff. I dumped it in a great big deep pool, and I got new ammunition from the RSM, ready to do any action we were going into.
Can you recall at this stage, can you recall the names of your sergeants in the company and the various platoon commanders?
One sergeant was Sergeant Hudson, MM. Sergeant Weston was another. There'd only be three. Sergeant Weston, Sergeant Smith was another. Smith, Weston and Hudson, I believe they were. The officers was one called Spicker, another headmaster, well, school teacher, but became headmaster. I met him 2 or 3 years ago. He died a couple of years ago, Lieutenant Spicker. Another one was a fellow called Reese, R-E-E-S-E. Now, Reese was a Cockney officer, a ranker, got promotion, got a commission, and was posted to the DLI. That's the only ones I can remember offhand. But they were good officers.
You're quite impressed with the...
Yes, they were good officers. I had one, I forget his name, that did let me... He didn't let me down, but he came to me. He was a little officer. He came down and said, "Sergeant Major," he was nearly crying. He said, "I've only got so many men. Such a section is the wounded of the Luxor. I can't make them." He says, "Get back to your platoon." You see, a young officer, I was Sergeant Major, now I'd control them. I said, "Get back to your platoon and look after them. There's no more men to give you. You'll have to get cracking on with what you've got." And this is obvious. I mean, you can't come trying to get men off when they weren't there. You can't draw them. This was after an action, yeah.
Can I just again at this point, can you outline the organisation and the way in which a rifle company was formed?
Yes, well, it's your company commander, your second in command, who is normally with the colour sergeant in the rear, dealing with supplies, rations, etc. So you've got the company commander, second command, the colour sergeant. Company commander, of course, with me, the sergeant major. Then you had your three platoon commanders, lieutenants, and you had your three platoon sergeants, your three corporals, your three lance corporals. I had my company runner, of course, naturally for messages that I had to send to platoons, each platoon in the area, go to 7th platoon, see if the ammunition's all right, etc. My company clerk, my sniper, a couple of company clerks I think I had, the stretcher bearer, stretcher bearers, and the signallers. That was the composition of a company in the line.
And your platoons were split into sections?
Into sections of, well, whatever you had. Normally, a platoon would be 30 men. 10 men in section, so that's a corporal, lance corporal, and eight.
So the total number of men in your company would be what exactly?
100, 120. 120.